Medication is often the first thing that comes to mind when we think about migraine treatment. But what about the role of psychology or behavioural treatment? Living with pain or a chronic condition comes with so much to manage beyond the physical. Can retraining the way we respond to stress, triggers, and pain actually change our migraine patterns? Today, we're joined by Adjunct Professor Paul R. Martin, a leading expert on behavioural treatments for migraine and headache, to unpack what the research says and how these approaches can support people living with migraine. Paul, welcome back to the Migraine World Summit.
Thank you.
So you've been working in this field of psychology, behavioural treatments and migraine research for decades. What first drew you to this area of work and what's kept you inspired to keep exploring it?
Can I start with what's meant to be a bit of a joke, which is that it's always said that researchers do research into their own problems. In Oxford, they argued, I added a corollary to that, which is that if you don't do research into your own problems, you develop the problems you do research into. I'd never had a migraine until starting research in this area. And then I started getting migraines. And even at my age, the only time I've ever been hospitalized overnight is for a migraine. So I have very much had the lived experience. And they were dreadful migraines with every type of migraine symptom imaginable. Having said that, I haven't had a migraine for well over 40 years because it is my area of research and I was able to get on top of them. But I suppose that's one answer to your question. There's a personal interest there as well. Some of the answers to the question, to be honest, is rather boring. It's pragmatic, which is that trying to get research grants is very, very difficult. I mean, in my discipline of psychology, the success rate with the National Health and Medical Research Council is less than 10%. And everyone knows that. So 9% of researchers don't apply because they know they won't get any money. So it's 1 out of 10 applications amongst the top researchers. What that means is that if the research community doesn't see you as a leading international expert in that area, you really stand no chance of getting funded. So that tends to also keep you involved because if you want funding for your research, you have to be doing it in an area that you have that international recognition for.
So I'd love to break down this topic a little bit. For those who may not be familiar, behavioral treatments might sound like it's only about thinking differently, but it actually involves changes in the brain and body and how they respond to stress, pain, and triggers. Can you explain what's really happening physiologically when people use these techniques?
There haven't really been studies done. Combining behavioral approaches with CAT scans and so on. In other words, studies that actually look at the biological mechanisms that may be activated by behavioral treatment. I mean, it's unfortunate that it would be good to do it. I've thought about doing it at times. I work, of course, with neurologists, but it doesn't hold the fact again. It's so hard getting research funding. And for various reasons, that type of research is hard to get funded. So I'm not sure we really know about the impact. I mean, to be honest, we're still very unclear about the biological mechanisms of migraine. I mean, we have this small book called The Headaches, and in there, there's a section on migraine mechanisms, and there are 12 chapters. I mean, I would argue if we really knew what the mechanism was, there'd be one chapter, but we're still learning, you know, so we know quite a bit, but we're still learning. I would assume that the behavioral treatment is impacting on those biological mechanisms. I think you can analyze any problem, whether it's migraine or what's more seen as a more psychological problem like depression, different levels. There'll always be a biological substrate, biological mechanisms. Then there'll also be a psychology side, like the experience and so on as well. And obviously, drug approaches really are going in at the biological level, whereas behavioral are going in more at the experiential behavioral level of migraine.
What are some different types of evidence-based behavior treatments that can be helpful for migraine?
The three that have been researched the most would be biofeedback training, relaxation training, and cognitive behavior therapy. So biofeedback training, that's really where it all began and where my original research was. So I don't know whether, you know, some of your listeners may not know what biofeedback training is. What happens in biofeedback training is you put electrodes or transducers onto people, monitoring some biological process, and you give them feedback about what's happening. So for example, you might put electrodes on top of the muscles on the forehead and then give the people feedback as to how tense the muscles are, either visually, like DAR moving on a screen, or in auditory mode, a tone varying in frequency. And the whole idea is that provided by giving them this feedback of a biological process, they can learn to control the process. So in the case of muscles, it helps them learn to relax the muscle. There's others. With migraine, the most common approach has been what's essentially hand warming. And if you ask what's hand warming got to do with migraine, the rationale always was that hand warming means you're increasing blood flow to the hands. And so the argument was that means you're redirecting blood flow from the head to the hands. And given the pain mechanism of migraine was always believed to be about extended cranial and extracranial arteries, it was argued that then that form of biofeedback travel, trained people to warm their hands, you were trained to bring blood away from the head, which was helping the migraine. So that was biofeedback training. Relaxation training, there's of course lots of different ones around. Aggressive relaxation training's had more research than any other. A fair bit of research on autogenic training. Cognitive behavior therapy is really more complicated because at its core, it's about identifying and challenging maladaptive thoughts and their underlying beliefs. I mean, to give you a simple example, get a migraine. If you start having thoughts like, oh God, this is going to ruin my day, I'm not going to be able to get any work done, heavens knows when all this is going to end, and so on. In other words, what we would call catastrophizing, although it's understandable why people might think that way, it's only going to make the problem worse. It's going to make them more stressed, which will make the problem worse. So there's that element of cognitive therapy, but it usually includes other things like educating the patients about their migraines, includes teaching them various pain management strategies, using imagery, attention diversion training, usually involves some relapse prevention training and so on. So there's a whole range of different techniques. But then it's also the case that, quite honestly, people often combine them together. CBT often involves relaxation training, biofeedback training often involves relaxation as well. Some people put all of them together. So different people use, you know, all sorts of different variations. There have been some new ones in recent times, although to be honest, I'm not sure how much it's really taking anything forward. There's the so-called third wave behavior therapies, mindfulness-based cognitive therapy, MBCT, and acceptance and commitment therapy, ACT. But there's evidence out there these can be quite helpful. There isn't really any evidence they're any better than the ones that were developed before, but there are more options. And we have moved in some alternative delivery formats like so-called minimal therapist contact, where we reduce the number of sessions with a therapist, with a psychologist, by giving them manuals so they can do a whole lot of it on their own. And that can work just as well. Some people have offered treatment in group format rather than individual format, and that can work quite well. People have converted to internet-based interventions. We've struggled a bit with the effectiveness of them because there tends to be a very high dropout rate with internet-based approaches and app approaches. And that's not to say they're useless or they're never going to be effective. I think we're still trying to work out how to make sure we don't have adherence problems with them.
Fantastic. Thanks for walking us through that. Sounds like there's lots of different options and lots of different types of behavioral therapies, from biofeedback training to mindfulness and CBT. And we'll come back to a couple of these to talk in a bit more detail later on. I'd like to ask, are behavioral therapies standalone treatments, or are they often combined with medications or other interventions when it comes to migraine?
There's no reason they can't be standalone treatments. I mean, obviously, when patients refer to psychologists, they're usually on medication. And of course, it would be quite inappropriate for a psychologist to say, oh, you can stop taking that now. we can't give advice with respect to medication. That's up to the prescribing medical practitioner. So they're often on both. Traditionally, when we do research in this area, you find that as well as a reduction in headaches, there's a reduction in taking medication. In other words, it's not us telling them to take less. They just find they need it less. So, you know, typically there'll be like a 70% reduction in medication taking in association with. What we really want in terms of research, I believe, is what is called client treatment matching research, where you compare pharmacological on its own, behavioral on its own, with a combination of the two. Then what you're trying to do is not so much work out which is best, but more which works for who. It's client treatment matching. But again, that research really hasn't been done. And again, it gets back to the problems of funding. You need very large sample sizes to do that sort of research. And it's just very difficult to get enough money to do that type of study. I wish we could.
Yeah, absolutely. It sounds like it would be fascinating, and that having that matching ability would be incredibly helpful when it comes to practice. You've written about something called a functional model of migraine. Can you explain to us what that means?
My approach to CBT is a little different from other people's, is that mine is very much based on a functional model of headache and migraine. Now, what's a functional model? Let me start by going backwards a bit. Medics tend to treat migraine, they approach migraine the same way as they approach all problems. The starting point for them is a diagnosis. They do that on the basis of asking a whole lot of questions about symptoms and so on. They often do a physical examination. They often ask for various tests to be done. And out of that, they make a diagnosis. Why do they do that? They believe the diagnosis tells the mechanism, which in turn tells them what drug to use. Now, of course, I'm not against that approach. It's definitely a bad starting point in the area of migraine, because with headache and migraine, what you're always most concerned about is the fundamental diagnostic thing about, is it a primary headache or a secondary headache? Primary headache is the disorder. A secondary, you've got headaches because of some other problem, which can be anything from a cerebral tumor to an aneurysm to et cetera. And of course, it's vital to start with that diagnosis. I would argue once you've decided it's a primary headache, worrying about what type of headache, migraine or tension type headache, for example, let alone what subtype, I'm not convinced is of huge value. Because, for example, I'm not convinced that they have totally different mechanisms. I instead use this functional model where I ask what I call the why questions. So I'm curious, like, if you got a migraine yesterday morning at 11 o'clock, or it got worse yesterday morning at 11 o'clock, why? I want to know why you're suffering from migraines at this time in your life rather than other times in your life. I want to know why did the migraine problem begin when it did. I want to know why you're vulnerable to getting migraine. The medics, of course, talk about genetics. Sure, that's a legitimate thing, but there may be other factors that make you vulnerable to getting migraine too. So I developed a functional model by asking lots of questions of people. Psychologists work with people very much in a collaborative model. Medics work on an expert model. They're the experts. They ask you questions, do the tests, tell you what the problem is and what you need to do. We more work collaboratively. So I develop a draft model, go it to the patients, and they're welcome to tell me, no, you've got this wrong. You know, that shouldn't be there, or you should add this. And the idea is we agree a model between us. And then that's the platform for going forward, because there are various treatments that it makes sense to use, regardless of the specifics of someone's migraines. Things like education, helping people understand their migraines, relaxation training, cognitive therapy, trigger management, pain management strategies, all make sense regardless. Then some of the rest will depend on specifics. So, for example, And neurologists will often ask you what your triggers are. And we know the most common trigger for migraine is stress. And if you say stress, they'll sort of write that down and then move on to a different question. For me, that's a starting point, not an end point. I want to know, okay, so where's the stress in your life? Where's the stress coming from? Is it problems in your marriage? Is it more problems at work? Is it more problems with your children? And of course, I want to know the answers to that, because it may well be that part of the treatment program might be, is the problems largely coming from marital discord. That one of the most useful things you can do with the person is help try to resolve marital issues. But there are other things. We know that social support is very protective against stress. If you've got a strong social support system, it really does help you deal with stress. So if I find someone's got very little support in their life, part of the problem might be trying to help them build the size and the quality of their social support systems. It's the case that sometimes onset factors have no real significance anymore, but sometimes they are. So that's really what a functional model is about. It also looks at the consequences side, like how does the person and significant others react to having a migraine, and also what has been the long-term impact of having a migraine problem. Because again, there are often ways there you might look for changes. I remember one migraine patient I had. She was a primary school teacher by training, but she stayed at home, looked after the kids, cooked the meals and so on. And her husband had the absolute classic old stereotypical attitudes to all of this. You know, what a great life she had. She didn't work. She just cooked. Well, everyone knows that's a hobby. What's play with the kids? Well, that's fun. So she would phone him sometimes, say, I've got a migraine. You've got to come home, take over, look after the kids, cook the meals. It would infuriate him because he'd think she had this great life, whereas he was doing all the hard work, paying the mortgage, putting the food on the table. So what would he do? He'd come home. He knew his wife always liked the house to look perfectly tidy and clean, which is a bit hard when you've got three little kids, but that's what she always wanted. So he would walk through the front door, take his tie off and throw it in one direction, take his jacket off and throw it in another direction, take his shoes off, one in that direction, one in that direction, because he knew that would infuriate her. That was his way of getting at her for asking him to come home and help. So again, in that situation, you have to try and work with them and show you can understand each other's situations, but it's not working. You have to have a different approach. You know, yes, she's likely to need to call him home to help out, but he can't react that way because it's just going to compound the situation, make it all worse. So it's like negotiating with the two of them how maybe there's times she doesn't need to really phone him to come home, but he should keep his level of support up and ideally higher. But it shouldn't be just dependent on her phoning up and saying, I've got a migraine. So it's about sort of working with them to get them to operate in a more functional way. Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. It's fascinating hearing the reflections on that functional model and sitting and understanding how stress may be at play and interrelating with physical symptoms and the migraine presentation. I like listening to your reflection of asking the whys and taking that time to look at a situation like that more closely and playing with it for a little while. It seems like quite an in-depth approach compared to the medical model, where it is often a quick diagnosis or a short amount of time when you're talking about something like stress. So thank you for breaking that down and explaining that for us. We've touched on CBT or cognitive behavioral therapy. Can you explain to us in a bit more detail what CBT is and what does the evidence tell us about CBT for migraine?
Well, the evidence is strong for CBT. Behavioral treatment for headaches really got going in the 70s, but right back as far as 2000, we had the US Headache Consortium, which was a group of seven medical and headache associations, you know, all the high status ones, the Neurology Association, the Family Practice Association, American Headache Society, and so on. They did all this reviewing to come up with evidence-based guidelines for the treatment of migraine. And they came to the conclusion that the evidence available for behavioral treatment was what they call grade A. And grade A is defined as multiple well-controlled trials that consistently give a very positive outcome for that result. So I think for a long time, never mind psychologists, the headache community, the neurologists and so on, have accepted that behavioral treatments are effective. But since then, with I think some people have got stronger results. So following that consortium, the American Headache Society funded a group of psychologists to do all this research, and they concluded that the average improvement with CBT for migraine was 52%. But like in the NHMRC-funded clinical trial that we did of my approach, the reduction in the headaches from pre to post treatment was 68%. And at 12-month follow-up, that rather than relaxing, that increased to 77%. So that's a pretty high reduction in headaches. An early study that compared behavioral treatment with pharmacological treatment, the reduction in headaches was 27%. So way below that sort of level. And remember too that drug treatments, there are hazards associated with them. I mean, there's side effects. I think it's an interesting question whether you want a 27% reduction in headaches if it has that effect, or whether you'd rather just stay as you are type of thing. Whereas the side effects of behavioral treatment are reduced anxiety, reduced depression, reduced anger, and so on. So the side effects are good. So overall, the evidence for CBT is very strong.
Yeah, fascinating. It's really promising to hear that there's some research that shows some of those gains and shows some of those benefits without potentially some of the side effects that can come with other interventions. You've previously published about learning to cope with headache on migraine, LTC, and the EASE approach. Can you walk us through what these are?
I use as an analogy anxiety because we know so much about anxiety. We know that the more you try to avoid situations that cause anxiety, the more those situations will cause anxiety. You get a so-called sensitization effect. Avoidance leads to sensitization. And that's why the way we treat anxiety is we reverse that around and we use exposure-based approaches because exposure desensitizes them. And I said to NHMRC, I think it might be the same with headaches. The more you avoid the triggers, the more sensitive you become to the triggers. And that, therefore, potentially makes you even more vulnerable. And so we should consider whether this is the right approach and should consider exposure to some triggers to try to desensitize people to triggers. And the response to the NHMRC was, they said, good Lord, what an interesting idea. We'd never thought of that. And then proceeded not to fund me on the grounds they thought it was speculative. So interestingly, I got some funding to do some research on this affair, funded by a drug company. And the results we got perfectly fitted my theory. I mean, the fit was so perfect, if someone else had got them, I think they were making it up. They perfectly fitted the theory. So the next year I went back to NHMRC and was able to present these results, and they've funded the program ever since. And we've had some success with it because the research program's taken all sorts of twists and turns. I've published a number of reviews in this area, which have been very highly cited. And now it's been taken on board by neurologists, by the headache community. So for example, you know, the European clinical practice guidelines have been changed. They always used to say, part of management is to tell people to avoid triggers. It now says, no, learning to cope with triggers, and references my work and this approach as an alternative. So it's taken a bit of time to sort of, you know, to get the changes in the system. And of course, lots of people wouldn't be aware of this. But in the official guidelines and in the research literature, lots of neurologists now, when they talk about trigger management, refer to, yeah, our studies and recommend the learning to cope approach.
Yeah, fantastic. And I'd like to dig down into triggers a little bit more because many people learn to cope with migraine by avoiding triggers such as certain foods, bright lights, disrupted sleep. What are some of the problems with an avoidance approach to triggers?
Well, just that it can make you overly sensitive to those things. If you start with our laboratory studies, flicker, glare, and eye strain can trigger migraine. Now, and I make the crack that I think after all these years, I'm quite good at treating migraine. I have to say, after all these years, I'm even better at giving people migraines. Because in our research, of course, we need to try to set off mechanisms so we can study them. And flicker glare and eye strain is brilliant. I've got this, actually, it's in the background of the office somewhere. I've got this, I have this thing where I have a stroboscopic light going off at people, flashing away, and they have to read rather small print off the screen. So there's the flashing light and there's eye strain because they're trying to read these words that are not very easy to read, and so it's brilliant at giving people headaches. But we've also been able to show that if we expose people to this absolutely minimally, they get more and more sensitive to it. If we expose it more maximally, they desensitize, they habituate to it, they build tolerance for it. So with my approach, it has various steps. The first step is really try to work out with people what the triggers of their migraines are. Now, I say that because, of course, a lot of migraine people say, well, I know what my triggers are. Well, yes, but it's complicated and their beliefs are not necessarily correct. I mean, if you look at some of the complications, a lot of people will say eating chocolate can trigger a migraine. Okay, we did a study where the big chocolate makers, Cadbury Fries, were behind us. They created all this chocolate for us. Placebo chocolate looked like chocolate, tasted like chocolate, smelled like chocolate, had no chocolate ingredients in. And we had a whole lot of migraine sufferers who believed their headaches were triggered by chocolate, take chocolate for a prolonged period, placebo chocolate for a prolonged period, or neither. Not a hint of a difference in number of migraines between any of the three groups. So we work with people to try and to experiment a bit. So if they believe a particular food is, to try the food and see if it does cause a headache. Because what a lot of people do is, since they've decided that, they stop eating the food, so they never test the hypothesis. It's complicated. I mean, there are lots of different triggers. I believe that triggers often aggregate together. You don't get a headache because of one trigger. You get a headache because there's more than one present. So that can make it hard to see, because you believe your headaches are A, B, C, and D, and you think, well, none of those were really much present before that migraine attack. But if you look closely, you'll realize three of them were there a bit, and then the three have aggregated together, and that's what's giving you your migraine. So we work with people, get them to experiment a bit and looking at these different hypotheses. That's step one, to try to be more clear what the triggers actually are. The next step is then developing plans. Do we go for avoidance or do we go for exposure? So, for example, we don't use exposure for everything. I mean, if you get headaches as a result of dehydration, I'm hardly going to say we'll go for ages without drinking. That's incredibly unhelpful. It's incredibly unhealthy. People need regular hydration. Similarly, if they think they get headaches as a result of going too long without eating food, I'm not saying we'll starve yourself for ages, because that's very unhealthy. So with those, we'd more work on avoidance model, regularly drink water, regularly eat food. But then some of the others, like the flicker glare and eye strain or noise, we might work on more of a desensitization model, trying to desensitize them to those triggers. Because the last thing we want is numerous different triggers. Because if they're then having to try and avoid them all, it obviously hugely impacts on their whole way of life, their whole lifestyle. So, you know, if we can knock off some, it works well in its own right, so that your lifestyle is not restricted. But also, given the aggregation effects, it may be some of the triggers we're left with not such a big deal, because they're not aggregating together with the triggers that we're desensitizing.
Fantastic.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. There's a lot to learn and reflect on there in triggers. And when you take that lens of examining them over time and looking at the other factors going on, I think there's a lot we can learn about our own triggers. I'd love to touch on a concept, hypervigilance. This is something that Some people might be navigating or struggling to understand. I know when I first personally learnt about it and learnt about it in relation to my own migraines, it took me a while to get my head around it and how it can relate and how challenging it can help people living with migraine. Can you explain what hypervigilance is and how it might impact migraine and headache?
Well, I think probably different people use the terms differently. So it's not easy to give a simple answer to your question. But I mean, certainly, for example, given the relationship between stress and migraine, going through your, I mean, hypervigilance implies that you're tense, that, you know, you're looking for triggers and looking for things that could bring on a migraine or make your migraines worse or whatever. And obviously that's a bad thing because that puts you in a biological state where it's more likely that a migraine will come on. So, for example, I do talk to migraine people that suffer from migraine and say to them, look, you can maybe think of every migraine you have as a learning experience, you know, where you try to work out why it happened and what maybe you could have done differently for it to have not happened or to minimize it. Shorter duration, less intensity, and so on. But I would encourage, like, if someone gets a migraine attack, yeah, spend a little bit of time, you know, trying to analyze it, work out why it happened, but don't spend too long on it because the last thing you want to do is agonize about it indefinitely because just like make the whole experience worse. And that's what we don't want. I mean, I do believe that migraines. Key mechanism of migraine is a sort of vicious cycle model. More migraines you get, more migraines you're likely to get. So that in a treatment approach, you try to create a positive cycle instead of a negative cycle. The goal is always that next week, try to get less migraine than the previous week. Recognizing progress is not going to be smooth. I mean, if improvement is that, you know, like that of getting less migraines, you're never going to get a line like that. You're going to get a line that's sort of going to go like that. The hope is the overall is down. It's partly the way people react to migraine. One of the words I use sometimes for quite a common reaction to migraine is what I call spring cleaning. You get people, we know migraine is more common in females, and we know that females do more work around the home than males. And quite often what they'll do is if a migraine comes on, or even if they think a migraine's going to come on, they'll immediately do all the things they feel they won't be able to do when a migraine does come on. Like they'll cook meals, the next three lots of meals. They'll clean the house and so on. And that to me, of course, is not the right reaction because that type of reaction, all it does is it guarantees a migraine will come on and it'll probably be longer duration and more intense. You know, to me, as soon as one comes on, you think one's coming on, it makes sense much more to get into that mode of, well, what can I do to maybe prevent it coming on? Or what can I do to minimize the duration and intensity of the migraine? You know, that should be priority.
Yeah, interesting. I'm sure a lot of people listening along will definitely relate to getting stuck in a cycle of migraine and experiencing once you've had one migraine, it can feel like more and more to keep coming on. And it's very, very hard to break that cycle. I'd love to pivot into summarizing some of the practical takeaways and what people can do. It sounds like there's lots of good evidence and possibilities for CBT and other behavioral approaches in migraine. But how do people access these sorts of approaches? Luann from our community asks, how can you find CBT clinicians that have experience specifically with migraine, not just for mental health?
The main journal for headache and migraines, Cephalgia, run by the International Headache Society, they invited me to write an editorial for them, which I have written, sent off to them, and is all about how we can move towards more people with migraine getting behavioral treatment, because at the moment, all the evidence suggests hardly anyone does. One of the problems is that the majority of psychologists have not had specific training in assessing and treating migraine. But that doesn't mean none have. I mean, this may amaze you, but I run postgraduate clinical program training my entire career. And strangely enough, I always have a whole lot of training in there about how to assess and treat migraine. So like my graduates would all have experience in this area. I do, you know, training workshops at conferences and so on. So there are some people around. But even if people happen to have specific training in working with people with migraine, a lot of the techniques are things that psychologists use all the time. So if you look at some of the standard things we use, like relaxation training and cognitive therapy, every clinical psychologist has had training in that area. So there's no reason that any clinical psychologist could potentially help someone with migraine, even if they haven't had specific training in that domain and haven't had experience doing it. They still should be able to help.
I know that some people from within the pain community may have tried psychological treatment and it maybe hasn't helped them. Some people may feel that their migraine wasn't taken seriously or they weren't understood. What would you say to someone that's had that experience and was thinking about whether they should consider it again?
Look, I think traditionally people with migraine have had all sorts of bad experiences. I can only say I think it's getting better. I mean, remember that tension type headache used to appear in the classification of psychiatric disorders in section 5 on personality disorders. It was viewed as a type of personality disorder. Well, obviously that's ridiculous, and that's not how it is today. Much more common amongst women. I think a lot of females in particular have had bad experiences where they've like gone to their GP and the GP has sort of trivialized the problem and sort of said, oh, it's women, you know, they can't really cope with stress, they're a bit sensitive and things like this. And so that would be a terrible experience for someone who has migraine and so inappropriate. I must admit, my advice to patients I see who've had that sort of experience is go and look for a GP who suffered from migraine themselves, then you'll get a different response, you know. But the problems are much wider than that. I mean, for example, I don't know whether you've heard the Global Burden of Disease study, which looks at how much disability is caused by different disorders. When they first did the Global Burden of Disease study in 1990, migraine wasn't considered, because also disability wasn't in there. It wasn't until 2000 that it came in. But having come in, it's now ranked as the second highest cause of disability worldwide. So I guess all I'm trying to say is I do feel, you know, huge sympathy for people who've had these bad experiences. I think it's improving. I think, you know, the world is more and more coming to recognize it as a very significant, serious problem that, yes, is going to be taken very seriously with, you know, every sort of option explored to help people.
I think that's a great message for those who experience that and are living with migraine. I'd love to wind up this interview, I guess, with a message of hope. Barb from our community asks, do you have any advice on staying positive when you're living with daily headache and facing isolation?
Well, absolutely. I mean, because I think, you know, it's always hard to know exactly how to put this, because if you ever talk to people about how there are ways of getting on top of your migraine, there's a danger that they think you're trivializing it. I mean, the neurologists often talk about migraine. They talk about it as a neurological disorder, and they talk about it being a genetic disorder and there being no cure for, and so on. And the trouble is that makes migraine people feel there's no hope. Now, I don't believe that. I think there is hope. There are ways forward. But I know some people with migraine then get upset because they feel then I'm blaming them for having the problem in the first place, which I most certainly am not. But there is hope. I mean, look at our study, you know, the 68% reduction, 77% by 12-month follow-up. There are ways forward. It's just they're difficult, they're time-consuming, and people need professional help to get there. It'll be a collaborative model. No one's telling them what to do. But it doesn't alter the fact they need that knowledge, that assistance, that support to actually go forward.
Fantastic. And look, I think there's been lots of positive messages in our discussion today and seeing how the field of research and care has changed over your career as well and where it might be going in the future. It'd be really interesting to watch this space and see where this continues to go. Thank you so much for your time and breaking that down for us and telling us a bit more about CBT and other behavioural approaches. Where can we learn more about your work or follow along and learn a bit more? I know you've mentioned you have a book. Is there anywhere we can point viewers who might like to learn more about CBT or behavioral approaches?
I have to admit, I've been threatening to write a self-help book on migraine for about 40 years. But I think I'm probably getting closer. I might actually write a self-help book, you know, so people could directly use that, because that would be the best way of doing it. I wrote a chapter. There's a prestigious series of 12 volumes called Comprehensive Clinical Psychology. They're supposed to tell clinical psychologists everything they need to know. And I always get asked to write the chapter on LA and migraine. And the last one was written in 2022. So there is a chapter where I've written about all the sorts of things we've talked about today and a whole lot more. You know, that might be a helpful thing for people to look at.
Brilliant. I'll make sure that we can link that to our viewers and they can continue to learn if they would like to. Thank you again for your time. It's been great to listen today and learn more about this topic.
All good. Thanks, Kate.